On page four, they come in and then they go into this energy production with the dietary things that you eat. So what happens, when does this bond get remade into ATP?
The question is, when ADP and P sub I get put back together to regenerate ATP, where does that happen? And I would draw your attention to the last part of oxidative phosphorylation, which is catalyzed by ATP synthase. And where ATP synthase gets enough energy to catalyze that reaction and have, well, where the reaction catalyzed by ATP synthase gets enough energy to be energetically favorable going forwards is from a gradient.
So where's the ADP and the inorganic phosphate? Where do they hang out? Inside the cells or the cell?
This is all inside the cell, every cell having to make its own ATP. You see, there's no central ATP-producing organ anywhere in the body that makes ATP for the rest of the body. Instead, every single cell has to make its own ATP. And more specifically, where oxidative phosphorylation is in the inner mitochondrial membrane. That's the membrane across which this gradient exists. So we're in mitochondria. It would be a real quick answer to your question, but I got a little more specific.
Are glucagon and insulin present in any food consumed?
I'm sorry, I kind of didn't listen to the very first part. Say it again.
With anything that you eat, carbohydrates, fats, proteins, whatever, would your body release glucagon and insulin?
We've so far talked about a high-carbohydrate meal where after that kind of meal, you would expect insulin levels to go dramatically up and glucagon levels to go down.
Go down with higher carbohydrate.
Yeah, with a high-carbohydrate meal.
Okay.
We're coming eventually to a high-protein meal tomorrow, I hope, to a high-protein meal where after that kind of meal, you might expect them both to go up. Insulin to go up a little, not as much as it does after a high-carbohydrate meal, but we'll talk about the benefit, as I see it, of the insulin going up a little after a high-protein meal. And also, this might surprise you after you first talk about a high-carbohydrate meal, after a high-protein meal, the glucagon level goes up, and rather dramatically.
Okay.
And we'll talk about the benefit, as I see it, to that as well.
So both with high-protein?
Yeah, with a high-protein meal. That's the only meal where I really definitely expect them both to go up.
Okay.
So after you eat a meal and your blood glucose goes up, it says that GLUT4 receptors are... Okay, I'm confused about whether your muscle cells and your adipocytes...
Those are the two right places.
Make more GLUT4 receptors or open more GLUT4 receptors? Or, am I getting this...
The picture that I tried to show in class already is that the GLUT4 transporters are already made, but they're not in the cell membrane until insulin comes along and tells the vesicles that these GLUT4 transporters are embedded in the membranes of. These vesicles then fuse with the outer cell membrane, and in that way, the GLUT4 transporters appear in the place that allows then glucose to enter from the blood. Back there in the menu again.
So this question, I think, comes up due to the histology quiz. And in the histology quiz, it's talking about the receptor protein being a membrane protein.
Mm-hmm.
The receptor protein is not receiving the glucose, right?
The GLUT4? Is that what you're talking about?
You
see, I don't call it a receptor. It's okay maybe if somebody else did. I call it a transporter.
Right, so the receptor protein that they're talking about in this question is the receptor protein for insulin, which then does...
Oh, well, that's quite different.
Right, for the glucose transporter then to be put into the cell membrane.
So I think he's trying to make sure that you're distinguishing between the insulin receptor, by which an adipocyte or muscle cell receives a message from the hormone insulin. A difference between that and then subsequent events that lead to the appearance of more GLUT4 doorways allowing glucose into a cell. They're both proteins. the GLUT4 and the insulin receptor are both membrane proteins. But they're two very different membrane proteins that have two very different jobs. One of them to respond to an increase in the amount of insulin traveling by in the blood, and the other to let glucose into the cell. Okay, I think we can go on. Who is next? I think I told you.
I was just confused as to why the body would put more receptors out. It just seemed like if there was an easy way to close them off, because you'd be left with all these GLUT4. But it's just a side note.
I hope it does make sense and fits your mental model of how things work, so let's work on that. The reason it would make sense for the GLUT4 doorways to appear increasingly in the cell membranes of adipocytes and muscle cells in the fed state.
Well, I just thought it would be harder to downregulate.
Oh, you're worried about how difficult it'll be to get rid of the GLUT4 doorways? Well, parts of the membrane can be endocytosed, and in that way, parts of the membrane with the GLUT4 doorways can be brought back in. And that will happen when the insulin signals decrease. So does that make you feel better about it?
Is there a difference between salivary and pancreatic amylase?
Is there a difference? Yes. They're produced in different places. They do their jobs different places.
They both break 1-4 bonds.
They do. Salivary alpha amylase and pancreatic alpha amylase both do catalyze the hydrolysis of 1-4 linkages from one glucose ring to another in the amylose and amylopectin molecules. So they both help digest starch. And as a team, they get things down to pretty small size, to oligosaccharides, disaccharides, and such. But there's still more to be done. Even as a team, they don't completely finish the job.
But they ultimately do the same. They have the same function. They ultimately, ones in the mouth, ones in the tummy,
Well, I think we're saying the same thing.
Yeah, I think
you think
so.
We're saying the same thing?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Can you talk about the difference between amide and peptide bonds?
There's a technical difference between amide bonds and peptide bonds. Amide bonds is a broad category, and you only call them peptide bonds when they're in the context of connecting amino acids to each other.
Okay.
That's when they're peptide bonds.
Okay.
And helps me understand why you might call a protein chain, a polypeptide.
So a peptide bond is like a specific kind of amide bond?
Yeah, in a special context is when you would call it a peptide bond.
I've got a very unclear question, because I'm so unclear right now. Lipoproteins confuse me. The chylomicrons, the VLDL, and especially pertaining to the diagram on page 22, where it shows where all the fuel sources go in the body, the liver, the adipose,
Page 23.
So when it shows the carbohydrate going into the liver and then glucose becoming acetyl-CoA, it's down to TG.
TG in the liver, in that figure on page 23, stands for triacylglycerols.
Okay, so
if you prefer, you can say it stands for triglycerides. I think if you read the caption, they say it stands for triacylglycerols. Triglycerides and triacylglycerols are synonyms. I have expressed to the class that I have a preference which one you use, and that's I prefer triacylglycerols because that's a term that better describes the chemical structure. You can abbreviate triacylglycerols this way, which is the way we'll find it in some maps, or this way, which is the way we're finding it in this map, finding them in this map.
Right, can I get that? But then when it goes to the arrow down to VLDL and then to the fatty acid plus glycerol, but I'm confused kind of the rest of that, what they're trying to say about how we ended up getting the glucose.
So here's my overview of what you're finding in that part of the figure. You're finding that after a high-carbohydrate meal, the liver uses glucose to make triacylglycerol, or fat, but not fat that it intends to keep inside. Instead, fat it intends to export. The liver cells export the fat that they make from glucose by packaging the fat molecules with some other fat molecules that'll make it with some other molecules, let me start that sentence again, packaging the fat molecules with some other molecules in a way that make the packages compatible with travel in the bloodstream.
So
those are the lipoproteins.
So lipoproteins are basically facilitating the movement of fat within
the body. Yes. The VLDLs are to transport that fat through the bloodstream.
Okay, is there anything else you want us to focus on with lipoproteins?
We'll say some similar things about chylomicrons,
right.
Where the VLDLs are important after the high-carbohydrate meal. The chylomicrons are important after the high-fat meal that I'll talk about tomorrow. To look at a picture for one of them, they look so much alike, the same picture works for both. Figure 32.8 shows you what a lipoprotein looks like. Then maybe it'll feel more warm and fuzzy when you've seen what one looks like.
Is what Sierra is talking about on the handout that you have, this arrow here, the via bloodstream, is that by lipoproteins or whatever she's saying?
No, that's not about lipoproteins. Lipoproteins are for the transport of lipids through the blood, and what you have found is is amino acids traveling in the blood. And amino acids really don't need to be packaged in any special way because they're water-soluble. And so they travel in the blood without any carriers or special packaging needed. However, fat is not water compatible and needs some special packaging with amphipathic molecules to be transportable through the blood. Yes.
It's real quick, but on the same diagram, it shows that proteins, it looks like it's the only fuel for ATP in the tissues. The tissues, I assume, to be any other tissue besides the one specified here. So is it that I just thought that glucose was kind of the fuel for ATP because it was more easily oxidizable all the way down for more energy. So I was confused by the tissues that I'm using. Or is am I reading that?
Well, you sort of asked me several things, so I'm going to give several answers to what I heard as several questions. She's still looking at the figure on page 23 that some of you are still looking at, and finding that one place on that figure is tissues in general, where it's indicated, for example, that tissues in general will use amino acids from the meal for building protein. So that's just tissues in general rather than anybody in specific there. And my next comment would be perhaps that this diagram on page 23 is not the best diagram that we're going to find for how amino acids are used. For example, follow the amino acids to the liver and the arrow just goes to nowhere. They don't give you any information whatsoever about how the liver is going to use those amino acids. So this is not the best diagram that we're going to find for the use of amino acids. And then there was something else that you asked that was maybe the main part of your question and was at the end of your question. Can you help me remember what that was?
Yeah, it was just, I thought that the body used glucose as its primary form of creatine.
Yeah, that was it. There's three fuels that you already know that cells will use. Now, are you speaking just about the brain cells in particular? Or?
Well, just for tissues, I just thought that the body.
Oh, so tissues, nothing particular about the brain here. Okay, so for tissues in general, you better list three kinds of fuel at least. The fuels I'm thinking of are the fuels that come from carbohydrate, fat, and protein. So mention glucose.
Right, that's why it's confusing because it only shows one. That's why I was asking.
Okay, so what would you have added to that? Maybe you're right on.
Oh, I guess everything else, because you can use it for energy, but that's why I was confused. It seemed like amino acids would have been the poorest choice to use for energy.
I think they feel they've already done a pretty good job at showing places using the glucose as energy. They've shown the glucose being used as energy in the brain and in the red blood cells, and also in the muscle cell there. They showed the glucose being used for energy. So maybe they felt like they needed to show that amino acids can also be used for energy, and that they did that in that kind of nebulous tissues box. Again, it's not the best diagram for how amino acids can be used. They didn't do a very complete job of that. But back to your question, so that you're not left worried about anything here. Tissues can not only use glucose, they can also use fatty acids, if we're going to speak about tissues in general. Not all cells can use fatty acids, like red blood cells can. But let's talk about a cell type that can use just about any kind of fuel here, and a muscle cell is a really good example. Muscle cells are going to make sure they get their energy any way they can, so think of muscle cells as using any kind of fuel I can imagine here. Glucose, fatty acids, amino acids, and also ketone bodies. They're a fuel that haven't been mentioned in class yet because they're neither a dietary fuel nor a body fuel store. But ketone bodies are coming up pretty quickly in our discussion of the fasting state, and those are fuel as well that muscle cells will use. So now do you feel like you... You're able to use this diagram better.
Can I ask a question related to that? So mm-hmm. If muscle cells use amino acids as fuel, the only way that's coming to mind is gluconeogenesis, which I thought occurred in the liver. So is there another way?
Well, gluconeogenesis is not using amino acids as fuel.
Right, they're using it to create a different...
Gluconeogenesis does use amino acids for making glucose,
right.
And the liver does that and then exports the glucose to the blood. You were questioning about muscle cells using amino acids as fuel. When muscle cells break down their protein in the fasting state, they use some of the carbons from those amino acids as fuel for themselves.
I also had a question sort of pertaining to protein uptake and also that same figure 2.2. So when amino acids are transported directly from the enterocytes of the intestinal tract to the liver, is that correct? So the liver kind of gets first pick of the amino acids, and then it goes to the rest of the tissues?
Yes, this is similar to what we saw for glucose and fructose and galactose after they were absorbed. Those are water-soluble nutrients that can find their way quite easily into the hepatic portal vein, meaning they go next to the liver after they leave the gut wall. The amino acids are like that in that they are water-soluble nutrients that very easily find their way into the hepatic portal vein.
Because this diagram shows amino acids going to other tissues and also to the liver, but it should sort of
but the liver
by
gets,
way of the
yeah,
liver to the
liver gets next dibs, and,
okay.
and then the other tissues will get some of the amino acids after that.
Okay.
Yeah. That's right.
Can you explain why insulin is considered an anabolic?
Sure. Question is, why is insulin considered an anabolic hormone? Because it stimulates building projects. I think of anabolism as building projects. Biosynthesis is an often offered synonym almost for anabolism, building projects. And insulin stimulates building body fuel stores and building body components. Like, there's no better time to fill up your fuel stores and to make to replace the protein that was broken down between meals and that kind of thing. There's no better time for all this building than right after you ate. And insulin helps cells realize that now is the best time to do all this building. So it's very anabolic. Has been abused by bodybuilders in what I consider to be some dangerous ways, because too much insulin injected at the wrong time can be deadly.
So it follows then that glucagon then would be a catabolic molecule. Yes.
Okay. Glucagon, often considered sort of an opposite in the messages that it delivers, an opposite to insulin, you just characterize as a catabolic hormone. Okay. And then there's some hormones that are difficult to classify one way or the other. Cortisol is kind of that way for me. Cortisol causes catabolism in some cells and anabolism in other ways. We've got some other hormones to talk about. Every time I introduce a new hormone, you should be asking what kinds of cells make it. And thus far, we've had insulin and glucagon introduced in class. And I've said they both come from cells in the pancreas. And yet I haven't nailed it down yet in class. I am going to want you to know that it's beta cells of the pancreas that make the insulin, and alpha cells of the pancreas that make the glucagon. So whenever I introduce a new hormone, that's one of the first questions to ask me or to ask yourself or to ask your book is what kinds of cells make it? And then because we've called it a hormone, the understanding is that it's going to go from the cells that make it into the bloodstream and then travel to cells throughout the body perhaps to deliver the messages that the hormone has to deliver. These cells that will get the messages are often called target cells. So let me try this now. The main target cells that respond to insulin by increasing their GLUT4 doorways are adipocytes and muscle cells. So you understand how I'm using the term target tissues, it seems like. And you're even remembering that it's muscle cells and adipocytes that increase their GLUT4 doorways. The next question maybe to ask about any new hormone is what kind of a chemical structure does it have? Because we see a wide variety of chemical structures, and sometimes knowing what kind of a chemical structure it has helps us to predict something about how the hormone will deliver its messages. And so I made sure that I did say already in class that insulin is a polypeptide, or you could call it a protein. And we're going to find that glucagon is also a polypeptide. But something I mentioned just a couple minutes ago in here, cortisol is not a polypeptide, it's a steroid. Now we're sort of back to anabolic hormones, because people who are aware of that term anabolism before they come to biochemistry classes are perhaps aware of it because they've heard of anabolic hormones like anabolic steroids that have been abused by bodybuilders. Yet, I want you to know that insulin is an anabolic hormone that is not a steroid. It's a polypeptide instead. That whole business about insulin being an anabolic hormone was something I planned to say rather early on tomorrow. We're going to look tomorrow at the messages that insulin delivers pretty early on in the class tomorrow. That's where we are, essentially, is looking at the messages that insulin delivers. And you're already knowing about the GLUT4 doorways from what's happened in class, but you might not have noticed yet the way insulin stimulates some building projects in the liver and a building project in the muscle. So we've got some things maybe to notice still about the messages delivered by insulin.
I noticed that in the text goes a lot more in depth to the naming and categorization of the enzymes. And the only thing we really talked about is...
Where did you find that in the book, do you know?
In the chapter that's farther along, I believe it's 27.
Where they introduce, is what you found, where they introduce the 6 internationally agreed upon categories of enzymes?
Right, and then there's...
Stay away from it.
Okay.
It'll only make your life harder to try and fit that into what I say.
Okay. All right.
stay away from it.
When ADME funds are being hydrolyzed, I noticed in both things you have like kind of the general amino acid structure. I'm just wondering, do the charges need to be there, or does that just kind of come out once the ADME funds are broken?
There's artistic freedom there if you want to show those ionizable groups ionized or not.
Okay.
So did anything I say there seem confusing or need clarification?
It can be or it doesn't have to be ionized.
Right. So my speaking about ionizable groups made sense to you just then.
Just right now?
Did I answer your question?
Yes, you did.
Okay. All right. If you show it ionized, you have to show the charge.
Okay.
So I'll look at how many H's you show attached,
right,
and then see if you showed charge appropriately or not.
Okay, that seems worth
it. Okay. Those are acid-base concepts that I'm more than willing to talk about. I don't mean to sound like I don't want to talk about those, especially if the questions slow down a little bit. Then let's take time for that.
Can you just repeat what her question was? Because I know you're talking about that. I didn't understand.
Well, let me know if I'm right. I think she asks, when you show hydrolysis of a peptide bond and you show the then divided parts that result from the hydrolysis, do you have to show the parts ionized or not? And I said that's up to you. Is that good enough?
Yeah.
There's the peptide bond before hydrolysis. She was wondering how should we show it after hydrolysis. May as well finish it. So my choice is to show the carboxyl group ionized and to also show the amino group ionized. So there are the two separated pieces after hydrolysis. I put in H2O and broke the bond. This bond right here was the peptide bond that I broke. The mechanism of that reaction, in my opinion, is something we shouldn't make any more of than this. Water attacks that carbon and leads to breaking that bond. Let's not get any more stepwise about the mechanism than that. Which carbon of an amino acid the R group is attached to? Okay. It's the alpha carbon, which I hear someone describing to you as the carbon that's next to, well, next to a couple things. How many people did I take this away from too soon? Is that good enough? In carboxylic acid naming, the Greek alphabet is sometimes used where carbon number one doesn't get a Greek letter. The Greek alphabet usage begins with carbon number two being the alpha carbon. And if there was a carbon three, that would be beta. And if there was a carbon four, that would be gamma. As you get further and further away from the carboxyl carbon, you use letters further along in the Greek alphabet. And the alpha carbon of an amino acid is an important one to be able to find. First find the acid group, perhaps, and then look at the carbon next door. Attached to that alpha carbon is the amino group as well. I'm showing this amino acid ionized at both its amino end and at its acid end. But there's artistic freedom allowed there, whether you want to show them ionized or not. This alpha carbon will always have one hydrogen attached. I think there's one exception to that, actually. and the R group. The one exception you just heard me realize in my mind is there's one amino acid where the R group comes back around in sort of a cyclic way and attaches to the alpha carbon again. And so that alpha carbon ends up not having a hydrogen attached for that one amino acid. Kind of a weird one. Don't worry about it. This is the general idea of an amino acid. The R group is attached to the alpha carbon. So if there's a beta carbon in that, where would it be? In the R group. There might be a beta carbon in the R group, getting further away from the carboxyl carbon. You might realize now why people call amino acids alpha amino acids. It's because the amino group is attached to the alpha carbon. That's where the amino group is attached, in the alpha position. Don't assume that the Greek alphabet will always be used the same way. Alpha and beta has already been used more than one way in class. You got to take from the context what the meaning of alpha and beta is this time when you run into it. Alpha and beta glycosidic linkages, for example, a topic that I avoided actually in class, uses alpha and beta in an entirely different way than the way it's used speaking about the alpha carbon of an amino acid. Let's go on to any other questions that you have before I start trying to pull questions out of you.
You talked about this up in your notes that people have written before. Have they underpinned your review as well?
The class notes, yeah. Are they on BU Wiki? I don't believe so. I think those are only available through the library's reserves, but those are just as easy to connect to, I think. The library's class notes. So, yeah, good.
So, in part three of the Fed State objectives, I wrote down in class you said that the active transport of glucose is considered a secondary transport compared to
secondary active transport is kind of famous terminology. What's your question about it?
So, because in the notes that, the class notes that we collected that is on the library reserves, you just said, mm-hmm. I think whoever posted these just had it backwards. So I was just wondering.
Had it backwards how?
I think it says that she called the glucose active transport a primary.
What the note taker was doing, I'm sure, was thinking of bringing in glucose first and then needing to pump out sodium second. That was just... That was just that note taker's preferred order in which to think of things. If you want to think of that in the other direction, that would be fine. If you want to think of the need to pump sodium out first, and then that allowing the import of the glucose. That's fine. I don't care which one you mentioned first. And so I think the note taker used the word primary for the thing she thought of as happening first. But the famous terminology here is secondary active transport, and you need to be able to explain that one way or the other, depending on what you want to describe first.
Carbohydrate and starch,
The difference between the terms starch and carbohydrate. Carbohydrate is way bigger of a term, the umbrella term, that includes starch and many things other than starch. glucose is a carbohydrate. Fructose is a carbohydrate. Lactose is a carbohydrate. Cellulose, even some things that we can't digest, are carbohydrate. And starch is just one kind of carbohydrate.
It's a little monosaccharide, but also
yes. You might say, using that kind of classification scheme, that there's these three kinds of carbohydrates: monosaccharides, disaccharides, and polysaccharides. Sometimes they're sort of divided up that way. When it comes to the monosaccharide carbohydrates, I've said that those are the simplest or smallest carbohydrates, where there's nothing hydrolyzable about a monosaccharide all by itself. It doesn't have a hydrolyzable bond. I knew for a minute where I was going to go from there, but don't know where I was going to go from there anymore. Yeah, carbohydrate is a really broad term. It's a term that comes from the fact that roughly for every carbon, there's a water in the formula for the substance. So hydrates of carbon.
I was just wondering, since the brain and red blood cells are insulin independent to transport glucose inside, which glucose transporter do you use? Like, they don't use glucose, so then
I was going to guess glute 1 and glute 2, but we do have that table so that I don't have to guess which glute transporters brain cells use. Now, when you say brain cells, I'm thinking of more than just neurons in my answer. I'm thinking about some of the glial cells as well. That table I'm talking about
27.5.
Was table 27.5. Do you know what page?
505. Yeah,
because
I didn't know if the brain was
glute 1 or glute 3. Well, yeah, there's glute 3 that I don't know anything about, really. So it's pretty important for me to check this table. So the 27.5 is on page 505, like you said. And for brain, I see glute 1 mentioned, so score 1 for me there. For glute 2, I don't see brain mentioned, so take my point away. And then for glute 3, I do see brain mentioned, so score 1 for you.
Those one and three for
a brain. Let me tell the class which glutes I care about you knowing something about from this table. There's three of them. Glute 2, I have mentioned as the doorways for liver cells to take in glucose from the blood. Glute 4, I have mentioned as the doorways that increase in response to insulin signals for adipocytes and muscle cells. And then the only other thing I've mentioned about these glutes and might ask about is glute 5 being a doorway for fructose absorption from the lumen of the gut, the enterocytes at glute 5.
You said all the time?
Yeah, glute 5 as a doorway for fructose. That's kind of tricky there. It's as if the transporter was misnamed. Glute 5 is a fructose transporter that we encountered as the way that fructose is absorbed from the lumen of the gut into enterocytes. Glute 4 is maybe the most famous glute of all. It's the one that increases in response to insulin signals. The number of them in the outer cell membrane increases in response to an insulin signal to either a muscle cell or an adipocyte. It's because of this increase in the number of glute 4 doorways that those cells have in their outer cell membranes that there's such a profound blood sugar lowering response caused by insulin.
What does glute mean?
Glucose transporter.
So, also, I had a question based on the notes that Gold put on the archives. And then she basically said that aminopeptidases are located on the fresh water of the luminal surface of enterocytes. Are those the same ones that are made by the pancreas and they just send it to the surface?
No, the brush border enzymes in general are made by enterocytes themselves, and then the enterocytes present those brush border enzymes on their luminal surfaces. The enzymes are embedded in the cell membranes of the microvilli.
So the pancreatic enzymes are just floating around the lumen.
Right, the pancreatic enzymes float around rather than attach themselves to the wall of the intestine. They float around.
The alpha dextrins that are produced when salivary alpha amylase catalyzes the breakage of starch.
Mm-hmm.
It says in her notes, 4 to 9 glucose rings result. And I don't see where 9 would be, because there's no range.
They're saying how many glucose rings. How big is the oligo of the oligosaccharide?
Okay.
Oligo is kind of a vague term. It could be 4 rings big, could be 5 rings big. The alpha-dextrin oligosaccharides tend to be in that range, from 4 sugar rings to 9 sugar rings big.
Okay, so the 1 to 6 linkages never get broken?
If it's an alpha-dextrin, I think we're still working on the definition of that in those notes. If it's an alpha-dextrin, it must have at least 1 1/6 linkage in it still. So that will need to be broken before it's digested all the way.
Because it says that even through the pancreas, pancreatic alpha amylase, it's still that 1/6 linkage is not broken either.
That's right. Neither alpha amylase, neither salivary nor pancreatic alpha amylase can break 1/6 linkages. They can only break 1/4 linkages, and they can only break 1/4 linkages that come from glucose rings. And here's part I don't hold you responsible for. The linkages have to go in an alpha direction. That part I haven't worked on with the class, the alpha direction versus the beta direction. So the amylases are pretty specific. The alpha amylases are pretty specific in what they can break.
And maltase and isomaltase, that break down the rest of it?
Yeah, even though in maltose the linkage that remains is a 1/4 linkage, when it's down to disaccharide size like maltose, the alpha amylases can't finish the job. So even though the linkage in maltose is a 1/4 linkage, the amylases, alpha amylases, can't break it. And it's going to take maltase to break maltose. So now we're talking about brush border enzymes, maltase, isomaltase, sucrase, and lactase, to finish the job of digesting the carbohydrate in that meal.
Prior to this, I was under the assumption that things like peptide foods can be broken down into amino acids and can be absorbed by enterocytes, as well as the carbohydrates that can be monosaccharides in order to be absorbed.
Had to be monomer size. Let's not say monosaccharide in that context. But. So you thought that proteins or polypeptides had to be broken all the way down to amino acid size before absorption can occur. And you've read otherwise, perhaps, and it surprised you?
Yes.
Well, I go along with what surprised you, that some small peptides are absorbed into the enterocytes, and they will be digested more completely inside the enterocytes because of some peptidases that exist inside the enterocytes. So we're going to see with the fat molecules as well as the protein molecules that you don't have to break every single hydrolyzable bond before some absorption can occur. So it's different than what we saw for carbohydrates. Maybe starting with carbohydrates led you to expect something else. The carbohydrates are the ones that are different, where you really have to break every single hydrolyzable bond before absorption can occur. You have to be down to monomer size for carbohydrates. Plenty more seats now. Yeah.
So this may be, I'm trying to think this through, but so what breaks a glucose to glucose once it's bonded? Just hydrolysis?
What breaks a
one-six bond?
Yeah, there is. There's actually more than one of those brush border enzymes that can break the 1,6 bonds that remain in, let's say, isomaltose or an alpha dextrin. Those things still have a 1,6 bond in them. And who's going to break the 1,6 bonds, you're logically asking. And there is somebody called isomaltase who can do that. And I think I remember reading, when I read carefully, what sucrase can do, that sucrase can do it as well. You would never know that from sucrase's name, but sucrase can do more than its name says. Yeah.
Part of one of your learning objectives said to generalize about the reactions catalyzed by phosphatases. Mm-hmm. So I just said it produces acids and alcohols. Is that correct?
It does. You better look for about four other ways to say it. So try another way to say it. The first thing you've told me is that a phosphatase catalyzes a reaction that produces an alcohol and an acid. Any other buzzwords to use and say it in a different way, maybe?
I have in parentheses glucose and
well, now you're talking about a specific phosphatase, I think. You're probably talking about glucose 6-phosphatase. But phosphatases in general, to get back to them, can you use the word hydrolysis in defining what they do? Okay. All right. I'll take it from here. Phosphatases catalyze hydrolysis of phosphoesters. This would give me an alcohol and phosphoric acid. And then here's a way you'll never forget for what phosphatases catalyze. They catalyze reactions where, I think you'll see why I think this is easy to remember. They catalyze reactions where water goes in and P comes out. Now, what could be easier to remember than that? I call them Betsy Wetsy reactions. This would be catalyzed by a phosphatase. Catalyzed by. A phosphatase. And now I might show that going into this reaction is a phosphoester. And we've broken it by this hydrolysis reaction into what you told me, an alcohol and an acid. Well, here's the acid. The P sub I, the P. That's the acid part of the phosphoester. P sub I or phosphate is the acid part of a phosphoester. And so I think I could complete this thought by just saying alcohol on this side.
Okay.
As another product. There's the alcohol and the acid coming out of that reaction. So, in trying to look for other ways to say it, we practiced the term phosphoester, we practiced the term hydrolysis, and we came up with this easy way to remember phosphatase catalyzed reactions. They're Betsy Wetsy reactions. Water in and pee out. Every time, if it's catalyzed by a phosphatase. There's a whole nother hour. But have a good night.
You too.
Do you think it's going to really thoroughly understand the two short test ones from the last 2 years? We should be okay.
No, that's not good advice. Because I, as much as I can, try to use different questions than I've used before. So here's what you could do with those tests. Think of other ways to ask questions about the same material. And that can often start by modifying those questions. You'd also be getting some insight into what goes through my mind when I look at old tests and I try and write a new one. I will change the format. Like last time it was multiple choice, this time I'll make it fill in the blank. Or discussion, I'll make it discussion this time. Or this is one of my favorite ways to alter old questions to come up with new ones. Switch what used to be given and what used to be asked for. So that I give you what I used to ask for and ask for something I used to give you in the question.
I guess I'm going to confuse them in the study guides to really understand why these answers are correct.
Yeah, clearly if I told you that memorizing the questions on old tests is a good way to study, I would not be doing you a favor, I'd be doing you a disservice. I'm sorry, are we thinking along the same lines?
Yes, we are.
Okay. Sort of like I said to someone a minute ago, don't just think of one answer to a learning objective and call it good. Or you're going to miss questions if I advised you that way. Probably start through the learning objectives so as to not display a bias as to what things I bring up.
Well,
if I did that, I'd go through the learning objectives rather than act like I'm giving hints as to what's on the text.
So digestion and absorption in chapter 2 on fed state. So should we like really know step 1 through 14?
No, I would never ask what is step 8 in that diagram.
Right.
Nor do I think it's important to even look at what's in that diagram and the order indicated by those numbers. But should you follow all the arrows, and embellish that diagram, labeling arrows better, adding explanations about what they're trying to show you. Like in the brain, I see aerobic use of glucose, and in the red blood cell, I see anaerobic use of glucose. Understanding what's in the diagram that well is how I suggest you approach it. Getting used to how information is displayed in this book. It's pretty important to catch on to that, to know that when they show a fuel going to carbon dioxide, they mean using it as fuel. But when they show a molecule going to carbon dioxide, they mean using it as fuel. I'll stop with those thoughts. That's part of what we were trying to accomplish with that diagram. Carbohydrates, if you eat a good healthy meal, wouldn't be digested at
right.
all. Yeah, I'm wanting you to think about dietary fiber.
Right. But those carbohydrates that are digested.
What other ones are you thinking about besides the meat? We said typically a high carbohydrate meal would probably have some starch and some lactose because of the dairy and some sucrose with such a high sweetener. I think you pretty much covered it when we talked about digesting the nose. What else do you think? Those are the digestible ones. Just know about digestion, I think, and also know about the food digestible or undigestible ones, the fiber.
I was reading that
the
paragraph in chapter 27, and I was just going to keep reading it for a second. Page 506. Part B, transport of monosaccharides into tissues, and it's talking about rate.
AM values is something I won't explain in class until the start of next quarter, but let me try and find you out with the reading there. KM value for an enzyme is a low value. It means that that enzyme binds its substrate very well. And they're talking about enzymes where the substrate is glucose. And so in that discussion, a low KM means it binds glucose